You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you're interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support. Digital Noise is here with another show. I am Chris. I am the host of Digital Noise. Joining me, as in 50% of the time, is my co-host.
Yeah.
Bright.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
Bright. How are you?
I'm doing
great.
Is this the new AI, Chris? Because I am not down with this so far.
How many fingers am I holding up behind my back?
52 or something like that.
You cheated.
What is this? You're trying on new bits?
I don't know. I just make shit up as I go.
Well, we know. We all know that.
What, like, who scripts their podcasts?
So, listen to Trash in the Can, every word from that show is scripted. 100%. It takes us weeks to learn those lines. Everything from what we're going to talk about, like about the movie itself, and all the jokes.
I used to like that show until I heard that. Now I'm like, really? Y'all write that? I mean, I thought it was funny. Y'all just came up with that off the top of your head.
But
now that I know that you wrote it, I'm like, wow, that's terrible.
Oh, terrible. It's a good two-hour-ish show. Just like Digital Noise. This is scripted.
But not today.
Filmed right in front of a live audience.
But hopefully not today, because we got some stuff going on. We got to bust through this. So we're going to jump right in with a title I suspect Wright least wants to talk about this week.
What?
Which is Justice League Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Hold part on. One. I liked it.
Yeah.
And the next movie.
Oh, is that?
No, I liked it.
You only think you liked it because you previously had to watch Justice League versus Ruby.
Which, can we have a little side note real quick? So Rooster Teeth is now disbanded or going under. It's a big studio in Austin, Texas. Yeah. And
they're probably best known for Red versus Blue and Ruby.
And Ruby, yeah. And so watching the Ruby movies with the Justice League, I look at the news, I'm like, oh, makes sense.
Well, you know, it's funny because they're owned by Warner Brothers now, right?
Yeah.
Warner Brothers is like, okay, why don't we do a thing, promote your product? And those were, I can only assume, incredibly poor sellers, right? Because the reviews were across the board terrible for them.
Oh, yeah.
And I can just see Zavlov going, well, you had your shot. Goodbye. I'm shutting down.
I want to ask real quick, did we kill Rooster Teeth?
Dude, everybody who reviewed those gave it a terrible review.
Oh, but can we say we killed Rooster Teeth?
And then they'll come gunning for us.
Yeah. You know what? Fuck you. I don't care. Because I've never really liked anything that they've produced.
Okay. Like,
when I say anything, I mean everything.
Back when they first started, I knew the guys who were the people who everybody knows, like, you know, Gus and what have you, like, cause they were just guys who were like starting this up and there was like a handful of people around them.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the original Spill.cons, they sort of like combined with us cause we were doing it anyway. Like, hey, do you mind if we like maybe,
is that why Spill went
Rooster
under
Tooth Con with you? And we're like, yeah, sure. We'll split the costs and whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's weird to think, right?
That's like, interesting.
By the next year, they were 20 times the size of us.
Well, yeah, yeah.
But it was because they were just straight up video games and video games were exploding.
They were so hot right then.
Yeah. I mean, they still are. They never stopped being, but you know, they fell victim to the same thing that we did in some ways, which is that everyone turned their heads and go, oh, is this a thing you can make money off doing? Well, I'm going to do that. And then professional comedians are like, oh, I'm going to do that. And for nobody knows who the people are that you have in your company.
Yeah, that's the thing too. It's like, it feels oddly big, but like, I don't know any of the personnel. I don't know anything that's going on there. And granted, now it's all under And, you know, best of luck to some of the people that I actually do know there, of course.
But, I've had many friends who've worked there over the years, many of which left under not always the best circumstances. But
Yes, that whole thing. But also, you know.
Well, those aren't my friends who got the one people who got in trouble. They're people who left because of the people who were.
Right. No, yeah. But I'm just saying, if they produced one of the biggest animes of all time, Ruby, which is.
Is it really one of the biggest animes of all time?
Of all time.
Wow.
And it, like, one of the most successful. And so the fact that they produced that, I would say, in the end, good riddance. So, Jesus. Justice League, Crisis on Infinity Earths, Part 1.
I'm sad that this thing that meant a lot to so many people was has come to an end. Really am. But I guarantee that a lot of this talent that you, of the shows you really liked, are going to go on and do other stuff. And I think that for some, that might actually not be a bad thing, because it gives them a chance to sort of reboot and refresh and try something new. So.
Yeah, you're sad. I'm more intolerant.
Oh, I didn't say I was sad.
You're sad for the people that, like.
I'm sad for the people.
Yeah, I'm more.
I also was never really a big Rooster Teeth guy.
No, I know, but I'm more intolerant.
I see.
Intolerant.
Intolerant is the right term? All right. Yeah, so anyway, Justice League Crisis on Infinite Earths, Part 1, which does not involve Rooster Teeth, unlike the last two fucking abysmal.
So this
releases.
Is good.
It's okay.
I don't know the story very well. The comic, I think the biggest thing with you were thinking that I'm not going to like a DC animated movie is because,
you generally don't.
Yes. But, every now and then they'll have something kind of funky, and I know vaguely about the comic story. I've never read it, but I thought it was kind of interesting. I liked the story with, you tell about
it. The original, comic book was from like 1985, 1986. I was like 15 when it came out, and I was not reading it because I was not a DC guy. Although ironically, the only DC character I really followed and would pick up stuff with was the Flash.
Oh, really?
But it was really shortly before this, they just were trying to do too much. Everybody crossing over constantly and wanting you to buy other comics. I was like, I think I'm done with DC. I'm going to just stick to Marvel, with the exception of DC's Vertigo, which is Sandman and all that.
Right.
By the way, a guy called the theater yesterday, whose name was John Constantine.
His last name was Constantine?
John Constantine. I paused and I was like, so you know, right? That he goes, oh, I know. I was like,
my life's a living hell, like John Constantine.
You're a lucky man. He's like, you know, I used to hate it, and now, like, I've realized he's the type of character that you should kind of feel proud to have as your namesake, because he's just the best bastard ever.
I really feel bad anyone who's named Wright Sulik out there. Like, oh, you realize your name is after him? Wow.
But it was one of, if not the first, big sort of attempt to from a comics company to go, we got too much shit going on, and we got a way to find a way to sort this out.
Yeah.
We created all these parallel Earths. We got all this shit going on. We got too many characters, even though it's almost impossible to keep track of our own fucking mythos. Crisis at Infinite Earths was an attempt to sort of crunch it together.
And then kind of reboot it after that, assuming?
Yeah, it's by Marvel Wolfman and George Perez, who sadly just died recently. This is the 8th installment in the DC animated universe, Tomorrowverse, which I didn't even realize there was a name for. Basically, everything that started after they ended the last run. It's one of those things like, wait, these are supposed to be in continuity.
Wait, the movies have a continuity?
Yeah, no, there's like the recent ones have decidedly had one, but I didn't realize that. And this
What is the Ruby and Justice League one? Is that Shitiverse?
No, that's its own.
That's
thing.
The Shitiverse?
That's its own thing. That's
the Shittyverse. The crap verse?
Yes.
Hold on, I got a few more. Hold on 1 second.
Okay, go ahead.
The poop verse?
All right, I thought we were going to do this fast.
Okay.
All right, thank you. It started with Superman Man of Tomorrow, which is actually pretty good. The 2020 release, which was their reboot. Like, forget all the old stuff. Here's the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a bonus feature here where they explain, like, they go through all the films that came out and, like, see, right there, there's the thing that connects this to this and this to this. And I'm like,
oh, I didn't watch that.
I was like, oh, I still don't see it. But regardless, this is a very Flash-centric thing, where it's basically, you know, speaking of John Constantine, he sends Barry Allen, John Constantine from the future, who's old, sends Barry Allen on a time trip where he's flashing back and forth through time at key moments of his life.
Yeah.
There's something about a super intelligent android that they defeat only by basically reasoning with and going, you know, Lex Luthor's a dick, right?
Oh, is it? What is it? The robot's called like Orgasmo or something?
Amazo. Really, like, yeah.
That's an old character, right?
One of the problems with DC for me always was the names were so
Amazo.
Dumb. Like, I like Legion of Superheroes, but come on. It's like Element Boy, Lightning Lad,
Atom Man,
Bouncing Boy. Like, seriously.
Boy Wonder.
Yeah, but that wasn't actually his name. That was the nickname.
So. Oh, what's his name?
Robin.
What?
Boy Wonder? The Boy Wonder is Robin.
Let me see how long I can keep this up.
Oh, my God. Anyway, so he's jumping around. It turns out there's some shit going on that is wiping out parallel universes. And Flash is, like, uncontrollably jumping from one to the other, including one where the Justice League is evil. Because, of course.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
And so he's like, well, how do we stop this? And Constantine sort of shows up every once in a while to sort of, like, help him with this. And it has something to do with Speed Force. And, they bring in a ton of characters as it feels like Marvel Secret Wars. Like, here's every fucking obscure, like, DC character
and then
gathered in one place.
Every other version
space.
Of those DC
multiple
characters.
Versions dealing with each other, people from different times.
Like, I'm seeing four Krusties.
Yeah. And you know, ultimately, it's like, okay, so, like, the idea is we got to stop this multiverse wipeout thing from happening.
It's a gravity tsunami.
And suffice it to say, they don't just go, oops, they all died. But it ends on a cliffhanger because where it's like, oh, now time has changed because this is part one of three, which DC.
Part three? There's three?
There's going to be three of these.
Okay, now I'm not liking this.
Now it's annoying, right?
There you go. Now I'm getting whiffs of Ruby.
I think this is fine, but I was like, I thought it was kind of confusing.
Dude,
I think there's a lot of slow stuff in here where I'm like, okay, let's get on with it. The one thing I'm still very happy about with the new DC animated universe is they seem to be sticking with Jensen Ackles for Batman. And I think he's such a great choice.
I like all the voice actors in this flick. And, I liked the relationship between, Flash and his wife,
Iris Allen.
Sure. And, So I liked where that was going towards the end. But yeah, I mean, if you've seen Infinity War, you've seen this movie.
It's Matt Bomer, by the way, voices
Matt
Bomer
was great.
Who's great. Yeah. I really like every time he's in something, I'm like, oh, he brings so much energy.
He does.
Whatever he's in. He's great in Doom Patrol on Max.
Mm.
Have you seen that show?
Mm-mm.
You should. It's like it's superheroes on lots of acid and it's fun.
Mm.
Yeah, you'd like it.
Mm.
Wow. And then Alexander Daddario is now Lois Lane.
Yeah, but she had like two lines.
Well, that's fair. They don't make her a main character. Anyway, this is better than a lot of the previous stuff they've put out. And it's supposed to be, like I said, the big conclusion of this run of stuff, or at least part one of three of the conclusion.
Ugh.
It's fine. I just hope the second and third installments are better than this one because I like it. Far from love it.
Oh, sure. I'm right on the same thing. I mean, I'm still not 100% down with, like, the animation style. Like, it feels a little reminiscent of some of the older, like, 90s cartoons.
I
but,
don't
like,
mind that. They're doing the cel shading look with the thick outlines and stuff. I kind of like that.
I don't know. For some reason, I always just don't dig the 2D animation look with the 3D animation, like big scenes and shit like that. I was like, oh, come on. And like, I don't know. I like when you watch old Superman and then Batman animated series, it's like, that's how you fucking do it, guys.
You were a little stuck in your time.
Well, goddamn it. Back in my day, animated things were just actually animated.
We need John Constantine to show up and break you out of your timeline and show you all the possibilities.
Let's give that dude a call.
Next up is the Criterion release for this week, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Now, I know, unless you're a big giant film nerd, you're like, I have no idea what that is.
Luckily, none of our fans that listen to the show are.
Well, no, I think all of them are, all 10 or so, are like, that's why they listen, because they love this type of shit. And even then, I know a lot of real big film nerds are like, yeah, I know it's a Robert Altman film, but is there some reason I should be excited about it? And this is honestly one of the only Altman films I hadn't seen yet that I really wanted to see, because I've had people tell me it's their favorite Altman film. But a lot of people also, like, when it came out, there was just as much criticism of this as there was praise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Altman doing, I know you're going to be shocked, an experimental art Western. What a shocker that Altman was going to take that tact. But nobody had really done anything like this before.
It makes sense. I mean, I think it is. It's a very interesting movie. I definitely see now, and you and I talked about this after I watched it, because you were 100% expecting me, like, he is going to find this boring as fuck.
Oh, I was just waiting for you to shit all over this.
I didn't hate it at all. I thought it was actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And I see now, finally, where Paul Thomas Anderson, I guess, only watched this movie numerous times for it. It made me want to rewatch Inherent Vice and Phantom Thread, because Inherent Vice is utter dog shit and Phantom Thread is boring. And
nothing would make me rewatch those films.
Well, rewatching this now, like, I have a newfound appreciation for just kind of meandering scenes with talking, but, like, it's really all about character development and having some weird shit every now and then. Like, again, like you just said, this is unlike any other Western I've ever seen before, where it's normally just people talking.
Anti-Western.
Yeah.
And it's 1971. Certainly we've already had Westerns that are beginning to counter the traditionalist view of the John Wayne, John Ford Western, you know? Yeah. I mean, like High Noon and what have you, the Clint Eastwood Westerns. I think we're just starting out at this point, I believe.
Of what?
The Sergio Leone, Clint Eastwood Westerns?
Yes, I think so.
I think it's like just previously before this, but that was a very different type of sort of like, those were going with this sort of, like, it still has all the Western tropes, but the hero is not really a hero. He's more of an anti-hero.
Yeah.
Here, it's anti-Western in the sense that it's not romanticizing the West at all.
No.
Like, your main character, played by Warren Beatty, is literally a pimp who is coming to this small mining town.
He's a con
town.
Man that gets in and just kind of takes over the entire town.
Well, yeah, but in a way that, like, ultimately, he's, you know, despite being a pimp, he's a nicer guy than most for this period, I suppose.
Yeah.
And people genuinely kind of like him. And he's like, look, I'm not fooling anybody here. I want to create a whorehouse in this town.
Yeah. And everyone's like,
really good. And then everyone kind of sees, oh, wait, this guy's not just some shyster. He actually is going to do this and put money into it.
Yeah.
And they all kind of get behind it and kind of more or less start working for him.
And it grows the town.
Yeah. And it grows the town. The problem is, the moment the town becomes interesting, then suddenly big corporate interests show up and are like, hey, why don't you give us all that stuff?
It feels like when, the two characters come in from another city to say, like, hey, we'll take over this whole thing. And it feels like, oh yeah, plot, fuck. Finally kind of kicks into gear again.
Well, it's because a lot of this is very, like, it's just experiential. It's just like, hey, this is, it's just character-based. We're like, I told you the plot, and for the first half of it, not much is really happening. It's just sort of like slowly getting to know these characters and getting a feel for this town, but it's so gorgeously shot.
It's shot beautifully. Like, I was telling you that thing where I was reading the trivia about this, and there's this towards the very beginning when he's rolling into town, and also the entire film has the score and songs of Leonard Cohen, which I really do like. Leonard Cohen, it's the one thing in this movie I kind of like, this doesn't
this is not
match.
My favorite Leonard Cohen moment.
No, it didn't really match very well for me, and it felt really out of place, and like it almost felt like it's like, we don't know what else to do, we'll just put this in here. Like, okay,
I mean, Cohen was still kind of like a little obscure at this point, I think. Like, he was, you know, he was like Dinosaur Jr. in the 80s, where people were like, he had his fans and people knew about him, but he was not radio material.
No, exactly. Anything, but there is a shot when Warren Beatty is walking in and he's about to cross the bridge and he lights a little cigar. And just the shot is, it looks like a fucking oil painting.
Yeah.
It looks amazing.
What's funny is that I couldn't help but think, as I was watching this whole thing, they built this whole town for this, about Popeye. Because there's some similarities. There's a lot of fucking weird bridges and stuff.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
I was like, wow, this kind of reminds me. Because Altman later did Popeye, which is, like I said, I couldn't help but see the connection there. Anyway, doesn't matter. I'm not going to go deep into that. But also big in here is Julie Christie, who comes in as the high-end whore who goes like, hey.
Well, she's a madam.
I'm going to come in. Well, yeah, but she's also a whore.
That's right.
She's just the highest priced one. I was like, I'm going to come in. I'm going to bring in actually attractive prostitutes. But you got to split the business with me. And he's like, ultimately, he's kind of incompetent.
You know, well, he doesn't know he had he's just ideas. An idea man.
He has big ideas, but he doesn't know how to execute them.
Execute them and continue on forward with them. But
I think what really, as you get into the third act of this, is it really starts going like, hey, you have a real challenge to, I don't know if your manhood is the right term, but like, are you going to be a coward or are you going to stand up and ultimately
take charge?
Hey, what's going to happen there? And it is really interesting how that all plays out.
The last 30 minutes is very cool, with very minimal dialogue, like dialogue from the main characters. It's almost like a very slow action piece.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting and kind of thrilling at the same time. I kind of loved this.
It's great.
It's great. And it's shot beautifully well. It's darkly and weirdly funny. And I mean, there's a couple of aspects of it where I'm just kind of like, okay, I don't know if this is supposed to be like anachronistic, where it's like the muse.
Anachronistic.
I can never say that fucking word right.
Sorry.
I'm glad I speak for a living.
I'm here to help.
Thank you. But also, like the costuming is just like, well, this is just 70s. Like, how I get it's anti-Western because it's definitely not a Western at this point.
Right.
Like, everyone's wearing bell bottoms and has like,
I think there's a certain amount of like, it's not, I didn't think of it as anachronistic so much as that, like, it was trying to draw a connection between the two, you mm-hmm. know, of just like this whole very rough, raw look of the hippies of the 70s.
Yeah.
And then the sort of, well, this is what we had to work with from the
I mean, you could definitely draw similarities between like the townspeople who are mainly apathetic and yes. just like, whatever, man. And someone comes in like, I'll, you know, fix this town up. Like, come on, hippies, listen. Turn this commune around.
I mean, this is definitely not for your average I love Westerns guy. This is more for an art film fan. This is like,
oh, totally.
I would compare it to Jarmusch's Dead Man.
Yeah.
It's like, this is not a Western for people who like Westerns. This is an art film for people who like have no problem with Westerns as being right. the explored genre. And it's gotten a lot of acclaim in the years since it came out. Like I said, it was kind of mixed upon release with mm-hmm. people. Some people hated it. Were
I can
angry
see it.
About it even. But it
just say it's boring. Don't be angry.
That didn't stop it from getting an Oscar nomination for Julie Christie and Best Actress. AFI has since called it the 8th greatest Western of all time in their top 10 list. And the National Film Registry, the Library of Congress,
burned the print.
Their collection. They did not burn the print. But it's Criterion, and this is not the first time they've released it, but it is now in, I believe, 4K.
Oh,
right?
This is the 4K, yeah.
Yeah. So all the, it's gorgeous. It's the same 4K presentation as the Blu-ray, basically, except it's a little bit better because it's actually a 4K disc.
Yeah.
Because the Blu-ray, when they put out beforehand, had been scanned to 4K. It's just, you know, only capable of so much on the disc.
Right.
Now it looks even better. It is really gorgeous. There's a lot of extra features, a lot of which are archival, like the commentary with Robert Altman and David Foster. And then there's a brand new documentary here that focuses on the production history and style of this, that was produced exclusively for Criterion in 2016. That's about an hour long. There's a brand new filmed conversation with, two film historians talking about this film. And then more, a bunch of archival stuff that has been released before. But it's fun. I mean, like, I like the Dick Cavett show stuff because, I love Dick Cavett. Mm. He was just, there's something about that guy that always, I think he was the David Letterman of his time.
He was the David Letterman of his time because, yeah, he poked and prodded a bit more.
And he was just so much more interested in seeing what would happen if he did something offhand.
Yeah.
But, there's one with Pauline Kael, who is one of the most acerbic film critics of her time, but certainly one of the most respected,
yeah.
who generally didn't like genre films, but she actually really liked this movie a lot. And there's a bit with her basically coming at the other critics who shit on it. And then there's a segment on there.
Fuck you having an opinion.
Robert Altman on there specifically talking about the sound design, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, the last shot of this movie will never, it's going to live.
It's rent, one of the best shots I've ever seen.
It's going to live rent free in my head forever.
Like, I don't know how they did it, because it is a long shot, a long like zoom in shot. And I mean, I'm assuming they shot all in snow, because it's the last part of the film takes place in the winter time. And man, it's pretty damn good.
Well, we're going to move on to a more traditional Western, which is Gunfight at the OK Corral. I believe
Gunfight at the OK Corral.
I believe the second film that had ever been made about this very real,
yes,
like event that literally took, I think they said in real life, 20 seconds to play out.
Yes.
Maybe, if that.
Yeah.
But like it
let's
was
turn it into a whole movie.
One of the most legendary Western moments that involved two very big guys in the history of the West.
Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday.
Yeah, and if you've seen Tombstone, you've seen a version of it.
Yes.
And I assume you've seen Tombstone because it's awesome.
It's awesome.
But I've been looking forward to this one for a while. Burt Lancaster is Wyatt Earp, Kirk Douglas is Doc Holliday right there. I'm like, yeah, I'm in. And also reports that this was the one that was closest to the actual events of what happened of any filmed version. That being said, it's still extremely, extremely far from the actual real story.
Right.
But I guess it's closer. It was directed by John Sturges, who is kind of a big deal.
yeah, what else? He did a lot of shit.
Bad Day at Black Rock, The Magnificent Seven.
That's right, yeah.
The Great Escape, Ice Station Zebra. Yeah. I mean, kind of a big deal for
more of a
writer than a director, but still. And honestly, you're watching this to see Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas interact with each other.
That's great.
The number one reason you're going to watch this. And just like with Tombstone, where that's the best part of watching those, the two main characters and their relationship, this is also the best part of this movie.
It's the best part, but it's different because they're not necessarily, well, friends. They are
not
in Tombstone.
At all at first.
Yeah, like in Tombstone, there's like, well, how the hell are you? You like immediately know their connection and friendship. And then in this, they're like, I've heard of you. And you're like, oh, fuck.
Well, I think they had met before.
They've met before in somewhere else.
Like one of those, they like, we're not on opposite sides, but weren't really on the same side.
Well,
either.
It's just Wyatt Earp has the biggest, like, stick up his ass kind of character, which I guess they do for every kind of iteration of him.
Wyatt Earp is the ultimate lawman, even though like the real Wyatt Earp was sometimes a lawman.
Right.
Not always.
And
Doc Holliday was like the ultimate anti-hero. Like he was like often took the side of the law, but not always, and was not was looked at as sort of a loose cannon.
Well, he had morals, but he would, you know, work outside of the law to get it done. Like he's the type of guy who's like he's like, by any means necessary, we need to get this done.
Yeah.
And which has a really fun dynamic between those two types of characters, where someone is going to walk that straight line and the other one's going to dance around it. And then how do they meet in the middle and then ultimately become like best of friends? But
it sold me on it in this film. It totally did.
Yeah.
And
at first it worked.
It was like, okay, this is fine. I mean, I love old school Westerns, like when they're good. And there are so many good ones. And this is one I've been looking forward to seeing for a while. So I went in with patience.
Yeah.
I was just like, give it time.
Yeah. And it delivers.
It totally delivers.
Yeah.
Like it becomes so much fun, but there's also a lot of like sadness and drama, because you know that, you know, again, anybody who's seen Tombstone knows that Doc Holliday is dying.
Not doing too well.
Yeah, while this is happening.
Man, and like I read a lot about this where Kirk Douglas, evidently he was such a fucking pro that not only was he thinking about his character and how he was going to portray Doc Holliday with him being also ill, because I forgot that Kirk Douglas was known to be like a crazy, super fit, aholic kind of person.
Yeah.
He even thought that he was like, I can't play Doc Holliday. That makes no sense for me. Cause like, I don't smoke. I don't like drink or whatever it is. And like, I can't do that, but he thought it was a challenge and he did it. But he was so much of a pro at it. He timed his coughs in every scene and shot for continuity's sake, so that when they edited it, it wasn't going to be like a different take and like, oh, goddamn, he coughed like four times and then this other shot did three.
Yeah.
And so he made sure that it was like a rhythm when he was coughing. And I was like, wow, that is fucking dedication to that. And really interesting that he would think about everyone involved rather than just himself, like, you know, just do something different every take.
It is really a great character film.
Yeah.
for most of it, it's a character film. And then it explodes into really great violence at the end.
Yeah.
You're like, this is a really terrific, long, much longer than the actual gunfight. But
it's much
cares?
Longer than fucking Tombstone.
Yeah. But like gunfight, like going through it introduces, I like Dennis Hopper. Plays
super
a small
young.
Role. This guy is related to one of the main bad guys, but he's like supposed to be like 18. And even like Burt Lancaster goes to visit his mom's like, look, I don't want to kill this guy. Is
you gotta,
there any
you gotta
way we could
get him on the straight and narrow?
Is there any way we could get him to not be part of this group?
Yeah.
Because he's just a dumb kid.
That was a really interesting idea that they posed with that character, Dennis Hopper's character, and him like kind of going back and forth with like good and evil.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I really liked like what ended up happening. Cause there's like, man, there was so much like burden and guilt and like Burt Lancaster, like trying to figure out what to do with that character. And it was a very interesting take on all of this. And yeah. Kirk Douglas as Doc Holliday was a fucking inspired choice.
Amazing.
Cuz there are scenes when he has his girlfriend Kate and Ringo, who Michael Biehn plays in Tombstone, he has a kind of a different relationship with him. I mean, they're still adversarial, but like it's not like it's they're going to fucking kill each other like right fucking now. And right. It's like he has a different relationship. Ringo has a relationship with Kate. And there's this fantastic scene with the three of them where Doc Holliday has been like kind of sworn in as a deputy and he just has to act within the law now. And nothing is like seeing Kirk Douglas show restraint in a way where someone is like bad mouthing him, taunting him, and throwing a drink in his face. It's like, this man, I seriously think, is going to fucking murder this other actor.
He is that sort of Western archetype of the man looking for his own death,
mm-hmm.
like who would rather die in a gunfight than die of the sickness that he knows is killing him.
Right.
But because of his friendship that he's created with Wyatt Earp.
And his respect for him.
Respect for him, he pulls back even from the biggest fucking insult right to his face and his girl being taken away from him and everything. And it's a really emotionally powerful scene.
It's pretty cool. Like, it's so well acted. It's like, it's one of those scenes that you really look for when you watch a movie where like these people are going to act the fucking shit out of this. And you feel the tension. And again, the way that it's shot too, like there are shots that's dedicated to Kirk Douglas making a fist,
yeah.
But like his fists are by his thighs,
yeah.
Or by his waist. And so he is just like struggling not to just leap over the fucking table and strangle Ringo.
And watching Burt Lancaster just slowly come to terms with the fact that he actually respects this guy.
Yeah.
And kind of digs him.
I really,
this is a bromance film.
Ultimately. It is. Yeah.
And like much like Tombstone and every other version of this,
yeah.
But it's a incredibly solid version of this.
It's good. Yeah. It's really, really good.
Really good. And now it's on 4K. It looks great.
Yep.
It's got a new audio commentary recorded by author screenwriter C. Courtney Joyner and film historian Henry Park, who writes for True West magazine. They still have magazines? Talking about this, there's a and then just a vintage trailer for the film. But
one of the biggest faux pas, though, no mustache on Burt Lancaster. Wyatt Earp was famous for his goddamn mustache.
That's true.
It's a fucking piece.
That's weird.
Shit movie.
So another, yeah, that's where you're gonna go.
I was like, you know what? I take it all back.
Man, we get a lot of old classics this time, like genre films that have been redone,
yeah,
in many ways,
or even been remade in the few decades ago.
And then we've got the Thomas Crown Affair coming out from Kino Lorber, 1968 heist film directed by Norman Jewison and starring Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway. And this was, when it came out, the very peak of celebrity culture, mm-hmm. for the 60s, because even Jewison admits, outside of the first 20 minutes of this film, which is the heist, which is awesome.
So good.
He was like not the first person to explore like split screen boxes of different shit going on,
yeah.
But it's one of the most fascinating takes on it you've ever seen.
Yeah.
After that, he said, literally nothing happens for the entire rest of this film.
I mean, it's a very tawdry affair.
It's just Steve McQueen, who was one of the biggest stars in the world.
Yeah.
And Faye Dunaway, who was one of the biggest stars in the world, like, who were supposedly on opposite sides because she thinks he's the guy responsible for this heist. And he is.
He is.
But he doesn't even need to. He's doing it because he's a bored rich guy.
Yeah, which is great. So I've never seen Thomas Crown Affair. And I haven't seen even the remake with Rene Russo and Pierce Brosnan.
It's all right.
I've always heard that it just like makes mom squish. So it's like, all right, whatever.
Yeah, no, and they were trying to do the same thing with the remake. And it's like,
no, that's what I'm saying for the remake.
Yeah.
But for this, I was like, oh wow, this could be interesting. I've never seen this. And man, what a fun movie. And I thought it was like, even though the middle part where it's really, I could definitely see the director's point of view where it's kind of meandering, where it has this very slow play cat and mouse game between Faye Dunaway and Steve McQueen. And where you are thinking that they're kind of falling in love, but she still wants to prove that he's the one who did it.
They're kind of conning each other.
Yes.
Because he knows who she is.
Right.
And she's not 100% sure he knows. And she knows who he is, and vice versa.
It's like, he says, she says, she says, she says.
But she's like supposed to be cool, and all the agents she worked with were like, are you sure you're taking this seriously? She's like, yes. And she's like, I'm fucking him.
Okay. There is a ridiculously, I think, sexy scene in this movie, and it's not a sex scene. It is this scene where they're having a date or something like that, and they go back to his place, and he lives in this, you know, fucking mansion from hell, where they're playing, they're having a couple drinks, and they start to play chess, because their dialogue between each other is just like seeping in like coy, like sexual undertones.
Sure.
And this chess scene where they're just playing chess is so sexy and crazy, because she is just overtly like trying to turn him on, where he is getting just distracted by, like, she's just like, you know, licking her lips, or like, you know, touching her breasts a little, or like just like her cleavage, or like scratching herself, and he's just like, ugh. And I mean, also the movie is trying to do that to you too. It's like, oh fuck, I can't like pay
these
attention.
Two people were considered the sexiest people of their time, like by far. So it'd be like if they did a movie like this with Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie, where it was just like, just a slow, seductive
affair. Fuck, that's
affair.
A great idea.
You know, like, I could...
Oh, wait, they already did Barbie together.
Yeah, but...
They should do a Thomas Crown Affair!
But that's what I'm saying. Like,
by Greta Gerwig!
Where it was like...
They do it.
These two astonishingly sexy now. People were like, yeah, they're probably the sexiest ones out there. And just said, yeah, we're going to do this slow, seductive affair. So ultimately, this is a sex movie, not a heist movie.
Yes.
And...
But the heist is awesome.
I will say this. Yes, the heist is awesome. No complaints there. But I was really bored throughout the rest of it. Sorry. I just... There's a lot of just like... rich guy worship shit in here that I fucking hate, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Where it's like, look at me, I have this Steve McQueen, I have a glider. It's like a really expensive glider. Isn't this cool? And the movie it's 10 minutes to him fucking around on this glider.
There are a lot of like egregious scenes where it is him just like, yeah, just kind of showcasing like, look how rich he is. He doesn't need to do this heist or steal money at all, but look at what he's doing.
He's doing it because he's that bored, which is sad. Like,
which I wish they delved into a little bit more, where they hinted at it here and there.
Like, what about a version of this story where the other character actually goes, you could do something good with your money, you know?
Yeah.
Like Elon Musk this shit, where it's just like, yeah. So, oh, you're so bored, you're going to pull off a heist just to do it that actually does hurt.
It's called
people.
Twitter.
Or you could take your money and do something good with it. I don't know. I'm being political. I'm sorry. But like, I was annoyed by that aspect of
this. I get it. Yeah. I totally get that.
Yeah. Just like, okay, I know it's an older film, but that stuff was true then too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but I also think that was the point to show that. I mean, the end solidifies it even more so. Yeah. I mean, the final shot of him, for God's sakes, of like what him smiling is like, it kind of says it all.
So there are some bonus features here. Audio commentary by the director, audio commentary by two film historians, an interview with the director, an interview with the title designer.
An interview with a vampire?
No. that's not here. And a on-set featurette in from 1967 called Three's a Company. So no, before you say it, John Ritter is not in this. Or Suzanne Summers.
I don't know what you're referring to.
You don't know what Three's Company is?
I do. It's okay, guys. Okay. I do. Don't worry.
Jesus Christ. Why do you make me fight for this?
Because I love it.
All right. So, sorry. I'm trying to talk on the mic. Next up is honestly one of the best things I have seen this month.
Oh, yeah.
Witness for the Prosecution. I love Billy Wilder. I think Billy Wilder is one of the greatest filmmakers who's ever lived, and film writers especially. Mm-hmm. Not an American, but came to the American film industry and was just like, yeah, I dominate now.
He just like, was like, look at me. Yeah. Look at me. I'm the director now.
Man, the guy just put out one movie after another. We're like, this is a 10 out of 10. And this is one of the few I hadn't gotten around to yet.
Yeah.
And I really love Charles Laughton, who is just a total fucking weirdo, a big, fat, funny as shit actor who just like everything I ever see him in, I'm like, oh my God, I love him in this.
Yeah.
Tyrone Power in his last ever film role.
Did he die?
Yeah, he died after this.
Oh, wow.
And
I'm assuming cigarettes killed him.
Marlene Dietrich, of course, a legend.
Oh, yeah.
Getting a little long in the tooth here, but whatever. and then Elsa Lanchester, who I know best as Bride of Frankenstein.
But yes.
She was Charles Laughton's wife, who many have said over time that they were both gay and they had a marriage of like
convenience. Oh, really?
But nobody really knows. But they were.
Well, we can ask them if you want.
No, we cannot. They're both dead. I do have a Ouija board, but. They were both very devoted to each other, and Charles Laughton, who had certainly her star had faded by the time his star had risen, and he kind of made her his co-star in almost every movie he did after that.
Oh, that's
nice. And this is based on an Agatha Christie play.
Yeah.
And her whole character and that whole element was added to this, among with many other things. Like the idea, he's this lawyer who's extremely famous, but at the beginning, he's had a heart attack, and he's just coming out of the hospital, and she's his nurse.
You have to take your pills. You have to get some rest.
Have to take your pills. Have to take your rest. You have to stop smoking. You have to stop drinking. He has no intent of stopping drinking or smoking.
I felt for her because I know, like, I'd totally be him. I'd be sneaking, like, cigars with everyone if I'm trying to still work. Like, what, darling? And, like, oh, these are nothing.
And, you know, he's like, he's like, okay, I'm okay with like retiring from being a lawyer, actually. That part's all right. I'm retiring from smoking and drinking. That's too much to ask. And, like, they're like, no new cases. And his friend brings in a case with Tyrone Power as the case. And he's like, no, I'm not interested. And then he sees the lawyer's got a bunch of cigars in his pocket. It's like, let's go into my office and talk.
You know what I love about movies like this? Because I have to admit something. This might be my first Billy Wilder movie I've ever seen.
Oh, my God. Really? Yeah. You never even seen Some Like It Hot?
Oh, no, never mind. Sorry, I've seen that.
Okay.
But
I was going to say, I bet you've seen other ones as well.
I probably have. Never mind.
I mean, the guy won 7 Academy Awards among 21 nominations.
Fuck me.
Yeah.
Wow.
He is really one of those guys.
No, I know how big and important he is.
Double Indemnity?
No, I don't.
Never seen that?
Dude, there's a lot of movies I haven't seen. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen Armageddon. I haven't seen
Sunset Boulevard. Have you seriously never seen Sunset?
I've never
Boulevard.
Seen Sunset Boulevard.
Oh my God.
I'm waiting for it to be on Digital Noise, man. Just line it up. But what I love about these movies is that, again, it's because it's very play-like because it was based on a play.
Yeah.
What I love is like, I love it when like there's basically 5 scenes where the whole like first 30 minutes of the movie is just that opening where like they get in the house. He's just like, you need to go to bed. And like, and then his friend comes in like, hey, I want you to try to work this kid, but I want to retire. Like, And then, but it plays out like that for 30 minutes. And then him finally resigning, like, all right, I'll take the
but
case.
But it's funny as hell for those 30
minutes. Oh, no, it's fantastic. And it's engaging. It's really interesting. The thing is, like, there's multiple characters coming in.
You think you're just watching a comedy for the first 30 minutes.
Yeah, well,
like,
yeah.
And then as it goes along, it becomes this intense, really interesting mystery courtroom trial.
Yeah.
You know, the idea being that he was married, but he was involved as well with this widow, who was very wealthy, who left everything to him in her will, but then she died mysteriously, and everybody's like, he did it.
Yeah.
And
I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it at all.
It's
interesting.
Really interesting. And I'll be honest, I did not see the end coming.
I did not either. Because I will say,
and this, the end end.
The end.
There's an epilogue that you're just like, holy shit.
Yeah, there is a fantastic, like, coda epilogue that happens that you just, it's another, like, double cross kind of thing. And what the, I will also say that, because I definitely don't want to spoil anything, because if you haven't seen it, you should, because it's fucking fantastic. It's
phenomenal.
But there is this, one of the best makeup jobs I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say exactly why.
No.
But I...
Which you'll know after you get to the ending.
And like, oh. I was blown away by that. Because, like, even to this day, you could still tell if someone's, like, in makeup, but, like, they're trying to, like, be, like, look like something else.
Well, I will say this. And people reported on this at the time. But the thing is, I'm not as familiar with this particular actor in terms of, like, immediate facial recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if this was to happen today with, like, say...
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah. You'd know immediately it was them, despite however much makeup they put on.
Maybe right? It was... It's, and depends,
I think
that's
certainly an effect, but I think it makes it even better now that, because you're not, most people aren't.
Sure.
You're like, I didn't see it come because of that, and that's great. Like, you don't always have to be the secret spy in the movie.
Right. But maybe it also depends on certain people and how good the makeup is and how much, differently they look. Because, you know, Matt Damon is in goddamn Deadpool 2. He's one of the hillbillies.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, what? Like, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Here, it's such a big part of the plot, though.
It is. I also am very happy that I compared this to Deadpool 2.
I'm going to cut that part out. No, I think this is really yet another Billy Wilder masterpiece. I still haven't seen everything by Wilder I want to see. Man, I still haven't seen Stalag 17, which people always say is one of his very best films. But, like... As near as I can tell, this guy had a nearly flawless career. He's one of those guys who was the Scorsese of his time, in the sense that he just knocked it out of the park almost every single fucking time.
I don't want to speak about, like, of course he was fantastic. He was amazing. He was one of the best writers and directors I've ever made. Blah, blah, blah. But,
you want me to give you a stack of his stuff? Cause I have a bunch of it.
Of course. I would love to watch it.
I mean, Sunset Boulevard is, when you watch that, it's going to change your whole fucking life.
Oh, like, well, there you go.
It did for me. I had heard about it for years. I was like, yeah. And finally watched it and I was like, Jesus Christ, this movie is like, I see why everything is influenced by this film.
Is it black and white?
Yeah.
Mm.
It's a dude. It's a fucking masterpiece. You did see Some Like It Hot, though, you said.
Who?
Some Like It Hot. You said you saw that.
Well, some like a cold sometimes.
Oh, my God. Okay. Anyway, there's only one extra feature here. No, I'm sorry. That's not true. There's audio commentary by film historian Joseph McBride, who is the author of Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge. And there's a feature with Wilder and somebody named Volker Schlondorf.
Oh, whoa. You want me to try to say it? Let me see.
He's got an umlauf.
Hold on one second. Let me see.
Oh, you want to do it?
Yeah, okay. Let me try.
They discuss the film.
Volker Schlondorf.
Do you have a German thing going on?
I learned German in high school.
Oh.
The umlauts are supposed to be like, ooh, that's what they're supposed to do.
I know a little German. Schlundorf. He's right over there.
Oh, and I sell bad jokes. I see what this
is. I'm referencing a great Val Kilmer film. So.
Tombstone?
Okay, we're going to move on.
Two.
With not a Val Kilmer film and... greater than I remember it.
Oh wait, is this what I think it is?
Yeah.
Okay, now the next few movies are Wrightsville. Let's fucking rock.
Leviathan, which even they knew when they were making it, there was much conversation about this. Like, we know the only reason this film even exists is because Cameron's one of the biggest directors in the world at this point, and he's announced The Abyss, which was in production for a very long time.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, we need to do our own version of The Abyss. For everybody, Roger Corman did. They were just like, how much money can we get together to beat Abyss to theaters and get on the excitement of people for The Abyss. By the way, if you haven't seen The Abyss, it's fucking amazing.
So I just saw it recently, the 4K release in the,
oh, nice.
In the theaters.
Oh, nice.
That one day in Austin that they showed it, it was fucking amazing.
It's incredible.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Not so incredible for its actors who still hate it and will never talk to the camera again.
I can't, if I ever actually was in a movie, I would never want to do anything underwater, around fire, around animals.
To be fair.
Hopefully just in a seat somewhere.
It was
somewhere.
The only point in Cameron's career that this shit happened where people were so mad at him that he admits, I lost control. I got too into my own ego and to like my vision.
I made Aliens and Terminator, goddammit.
No, I mean, like, no one else who's ever worked with him ever had a bad thing to say about the guy. Well, but like only Mastriano, I think is her name. And
oh,
Harris,
fuck. I
who
forget
refused
her name.
To ever come back and work with him because he was just such a dick on this. Because yeah. He's like, had his, I have my vision. And like, I mean, he lost control and
it sucks because like Michael Biehn never worked with him again.
But that being said, nobody lost control on Leviathan or the other film coming that was
sure
made
about
at the
that?
Same time, Deep Star 6.
Oh yeah.
Which I also own a copy of.
I've never seen that actually.
It's about the same as Leviathan.
Okay,
which is
it
to
is
say
Schlock City.
They're monsters underwater. Both of which having no idea what The Abyss actually was going to be about, clearly.
It's like, there's going to be monsters, right?
It's going to be a monster underwater film. Like, yeah, you're not. I think you think too little of James Cameron.
Well, that and it's like, well, I mean, they're not going to actually shoot in the water, right? And like, yeah, you really don't know James Cameron.
I mean,
because here they don't shoot in the water, really. They do this really clever effect when they're deep sea miners. They're mining for shit. And,
As one does.
And they do this really fun effect when all the actors are in their suits. Whiskey. They are blowing this leaf blowers.
Sorry, I had something entirely different in my head when you started that sentence.
They started blowing cocaine everywhere. No,
was there a deleted scene I missed?
So you see all these like little flakes that make it look like they're underwater. It's like this little cotton pieces that just like blow everywhere and it falls very slowly. So it looks like they're underwater and it's a pretty clever effect. Here's the one thing I will say about Leviathan. Now, when I say this word, I don't mean the story nor the acting 100%, but this movie is fucking clever.
I like this movie.
I like it too.
I need to rewatch Deep Star 6 now because I thought these effects were actually really good here, mm-hmm. the practical effects that were done.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Apparently at the time people said Deep Star, there was a lot of comparison and people really preferred Deep Star 6 as a monster effect.
Oh shit, okay.
So I'm like, oh wow, cause I thought these were great outside of the epilogue monster scene, which is terrible. Like
that,
when you finally see the whole monster, you're just like, that doesn't
look open wide, motherfucker.
I think Ernie Hudson described it as a space chicken.
Well, that is so. I love the ending of Leviathan, where there is a big monster that he discovered, blah blah blah. But the Peter Weller RoboCop, he tries
and
to
Buckaroo Banzai.
Whatever, and he tries to exude so much like Roy Scheider in this this final scene where the monster is like, you know, above the water and Peter Weller has some dynamite.
Smile you son of a bitch.
Okay, smiles you son of a bitch. That's the first one in Jaws. And then the second one, he says, because the shark is running or swimming towards him, and he has this electrical beam, and it's going to electrocute the shark. And then he's like, open wide! And so in this, he says, say ah, motherfucker!
Same thing. I mean,
it's great.
This movie is deeply ripping off
the Alien,
Thing,
Jaws,
Alien,
Thing,
Jaws, no question.
Maybe The Abyss.
But the funny thing is, well, nobody, they hadn't seen
No,
the
I know,
mission.
I know. But they
but
said
the,
maybe.
You know, it's ripping off the film they thought The Abyss was going to be. Mm-hmm. But it's a funny thing about time that over time you go back and you look at all the people involved and you go, this wasn't so bad. Like it was mainly bad
it wasn't so good
compared to like The Abyss, which
yes.
is a 10 out of 10 masterpiece.
Right.
You know, this is a
a schlocky
but good schlocky little underwater alien and the thing type movie.
It with helps.
A great cast.
The cast is like front to back.
Peter Weller, Richard Crenna, Ernie Hudson, Amanda Pays, and Daniel Stern. You're just like, this is a great. Hector Elizondo.
And the other guy, Michael Carmine?
I said Carmine. Jesus.
Carmine. I don't know. He's the guy from, I believe that's the character. He's the guy from Batteries Not Included. He's the bad guy.
Yeah, I've never actually watched that movie.
You haven't seen Batteries Not Included?
But he played a...
I heard it's just as good as Sunset Boulevard.
Played a recurring role of Snake on Miami Vice, the television show.
Oh. Yeah.
And he was in Band of the Hand as one of the main characters.
Hey, where are my Batteries Not Included people at? Come on now.
Nowhere. Anyway, Peter Weller, solid performance in the lead. Amanda Pays was, for sci-fi geeks, one of the hottest women in the world at that point.
She was in the movie called The Kindred.
Yeah, she was.
You can listen to that episode on Trash of the Can.
She's hot.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Meg Foster.
With the bright eyes.
With the gray eyes. Yeah,
she's crazy. Evelyn.
So it's like a deep sea mining operation. This crew is down there who's committed to being there for a while. They find a Soviet shipwreck underwater called Leviathan. They find a safe in there. There's a bottle of vodka in there. And of course, they're like, no one can have this vodka. And then, like, of course, they take the vodka and drink it. And the problem is the vodka has got like this biological element in it that causes people to turn into the thing.
It's called Russian vodka. So, it will turn you into monster.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can bear witness to that. Sir.
Right. I think it's actually more of a comment on Russian vodka
but
than
the effects
anything
are
else.
Great. It's Stan Winston doing the effects. They're disturbing and cool. Like, and I admit, when it gets to the point where it finally shows you the whole monster, it looks crappy. But, like, usually you're just seeing pieces of it and like body parts,
tentacles
like
very and shit.
The thing style mutating out.
Yeah.
And just like, oh, that's really cool. This was fun.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's been a long time since I've seen it. And I don't think I am sure I reacted to this more negatively the last time I saw it. But this time I'm like the benefit of time and going like, hey, this isn't such a bad movie. And it's well worth seeing.
Everyone is giving it oddly too much effort. And because they really, I think some of them sort of think that they're like, I think we're about to do an Alien again. And then they didn't.
No.
And then oops.
No, only one guy ever did that. And it was James Cameron.
But yeah, it was fun.
Successfully.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good little fun time.
And this is on 4K. Wow, I can't believe
it looks fucking great.
4K, but it looks great. Yeah. New audio commentary with two film critics, Steve Mitchell and Nathaniel Thompson, that talk about all sorts of things here. And then there's on the Blu-ray disc, there's a bunch of the archival programs from previously released versions of this film. It is it's a solid release. And then we have Burnt Offerings.
Hold on 1 second. Little tidbit.
Yeah.
You know who directed this movie?
George Cosmatos?
Who did Tombstone.
Boom! Oh, I didn't realize he did Tombstone. Wow, full circle.
Full fucking circle.
Next up is Burnt Offerings, 1976 supernatural horror film directed by Dan Curtis, who was best known for being one of the main directors on the British horror show Dark Shadows.
Okay.
Yeah. And it stars Karen Black, Oliver Reed, Betty Davis, Lee Montgomery, Burgess Meredith, Anthony James, based on a novel of the same name from 1973. Certainly we were in the midst at this point of this release, when this came out in 1976 of like, hey, horror is big right now. And they were attracting big actors to horror and going, let's give it a shot.
It worked for The Omen.
And it's not a wildly successful version of that, but I think this is one of those, like, you know when people always talk about don't remake great movies, remake movies that were, like, had a great idea but weren't great?
Yeah.
I think this is one of those, I'm like, I would kind of love to see someone remake this. Because there's a lot of good stuff here idea-wise. And I will say this. Oliver Reed, who has no fucks to give and is just explosively chewing up every part of scenery, is pure pleasure to watch for me.
It's really fun to watch him in this. I did not care for this movie that much. I thought it was Very boring.
It didn't bore me.
Oh, man, I was bored to tears.
You cried?
I cried. Jesus, there's a lot of so crying sorry. When I watch Digital Noise movies sometimes, okay? But he carried it, because I have to, can I be mean for a minute?
Well, nothing's ever stopped you before.
I don't really care for Karen Black.
All right, so Karen Black freaks me out.
Right!
Like, I think that she's often appropriately cast in things I've seen. Like, we talked about...
Like, House of Thousand Corpses.
We talked about The Day of the Locust. Which I think is her most appropriately cast film role I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Because she's like this...
I get that.
...person who wants to be Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And, or the equivalent at the time.
Yeah.
And she's just off. She's like, yes, yeah, she's beautiful, but she's off. She's got kind of a lazy eye thing going on.
My mom would say a very offensive thing. It's like, oh, man, she's cockeyed. And so it's just like, it's just, there's something off about her, which works. But the thing is, like, I don't know what to take from her at that point, because I feel like, well, okay, so I'm immediately not trusting her. Like, something, she is cast in this role for a reason.
Anytime she's in a part, you know there's something off,
right,
with her.
And I think that
she has that whole, like, pretty, but something's wrong.
Funky. Something funky.
But, you know, I mean, that's fine. There are a lot of actors like that.
But it does help, I'll give this movie some credit, with the casting especially, is that Oliver Reed is so intense that you're just like, well, he's the fucking awful villain of whatever the hell this is going to.
I love that Bette Davis, who, this is one of her last roles.
Oh, man.
Of
course. I was like, I think this counts as elderly abuse of what they're doing to her.
But she was like, I fucking hate Oliver Reed so much. She was very loud. And Oliver Reed was not popular among other actors. Like, apparently,
he was the biggest drunk in the world.
Yeah, he was huge drunk. But he's a just absolute insane pleasure to watch work. Just like Peter O'Toole. You're just like, yeah, you're a huge drunk, but oh my God, it's fun to watch you work.
Yeah, I mean, Oliver Reed just seems like he is about to fucking punch anyone. Which he is about to fucking punch his own son in this movie numerous times.
The idea being, he plays a writer, his wife, Karen Black, and their 12-year-old son. They have rented this old 19th century mansion for the summer. They meet the eccentric owners of the place, one of which played
Burgess Meredith,
who offer the most super cheap price for the thing. The ultimate deal, like, you just taking it. It's the Shining, basically.
Yes, it's just a Shining.
And in fact, there's a lot of similarities to the Shining.
Well, it's the Shining and the Amityville.
Because it's very like, it's the house itself is evil.
Yes.
And it has multiple forces, it feels like, going on towards evil. And it's not as straightforward as The Shining.
No.
Yes, it's just coming after this one character, because it's coming after everyone.
Right.
But I really liked those aspects of it. I was enjoying watching that quite a bit. Again, I kept going, I realize this could be a lot better, but I love it. As a story, I love what it's doing. I just wish it was better the way it was doing it.
Yeah.
And there are moments that I thought were awesome. Like, there's this whole, the idea that this eats, the house eats people, kind of, in a way. And as it starts making the people who live there more fucked up, it starts shedding its skin and refreshing itself. So this is, I thought, amazing scene where, like, all the shingles in the house are just shedding off of it and flying off, and new shingles are being born, and it's looking fresher and newer. And that's really fucking cool. The idea of this house is like a vampire living off people.
Yeah. I like the scene where Oliver Reed was trying to, like, drown his son. That was kind of fun. And,
and that was it?
I'm sorry. Like, I thought it was incredibly boring. It was such a slog to get through to, like, all right, what the fuck is happening? Let's go pick up the fucking pace. Now, granted, I did like a lot the last, like, 15 or 20 minutes or so, because it was going places where, like, oh, well, this is a little bit more interesting, finally. And, that it was showing Oliver Reed's character in a very vulnerable light, and I dug that, because he was so intense the entire goddamn time, and things are starting to turn, like, real bad real quick, and, like, the last, like, couple of minutes where it's like, whoa, what the fuck is going on here? I like that part a lot.
One of my biggest problems with this is one of the creepiest parts doesn't really work because you never really understand it. That no. He has this flashback to a creepy chauffeur from his past.
What the fuck?
And it doesn't make any sense because it never really feels like it melds into the bigger story.
I honestly thought it was like, was he like... Nazi or something?
He is creepy as fuck looking, no question.
Oh, sure.
But you're just like, okay, so I get that it's like, I get what the movie wants to do, the idea that like, oh, it's taking stuff from these people's heads to fuck with them.
Yeah.
But it never really comes, it's not really overtly clear.
It's like the ghosts in The Shining, where they would see ghosts like down the hallway, like da-da-da-da-da. And then in this, it's like, oh my gosh, chauffeur, what is he from? Like, yeah. It just, I was like, wait, what?
I wanted this to be better than it was, but I do think I understand why some people consider it a cult classic.
Sure.
It is got more than enough interesting aspects to make it well worth watching. And again, a film, I think this is such a cool idea. And there's so many cool ideas in it that are executed poorly by a TV director who this was literally the only feature film he ever made. That you're like, yeah, this feels like a TV film. I could only imagine someone else better taking all this material could do some amazing shit with it.
Yeah. I just, the way that it was ultimately also shot most of the time too, just like, again, just it bored me to tears. I appreciate that you would recommend watching it. I definitely do not. I mean, if you like those,
I'm a big
slow burn kind of horror movies.
I'm a big ghost horror guy,
yeah,
like a haunted house movie guy. Like that's one of my favorite subgenres. So I'm very forgiving, and I've certainly my friend Martin Thomas has accused me any number of times of being too kind because how much I love that.
If I dig them. If they're either super schlocky, jump scary, yeah. I'm totally fine with that. I don't care about.
No, I don't want that.
Oh, I love that stuff.
That's why I like Mike Flanagan so much. Slow burn, character building.
I love that stuff too. I prefer that. But this, where it's like, I don't care about any of these people and I don't know what the fuck is happening. And this is just not, it's way too long.
Which brings me to the question. How do you feel about the fact they're making 13 Ghosts into a television series?
What?
Have you seen that?
No.
Yeah, you know.
Who?
Yeah, I forget what it's on, but yeah, it's already in production. They're making a 13 Ghosts TV show with 13 episodes, shockingly.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, which is a remake of an old crappy movie.
No, I know.
And then it made a crappy movie out of a crappy movie.
Well, yeah. I mean, some could argue that movie was kind of fun.
Okay.
Tony Shalhoub is like a starring role.
You know
do that
what?
All the time.
This comes with audio commentary with Dan Curtis, Karen Black, and William F. Nolan. There's audio commentary by Richard Harlan Smith. There's an interview with actor Anthony James. Another one with Lee Montgomery. Interview with the screenwriter William F. Nolan. Trailers from Hell. Look at it with Steve Senske. Animated footage of the images here in the original theatrical trailer. Okay, there's a decent amount of stuff here to make it worth your while if this is something you're interested in. Now we're going to come to the movie that. You were way more excited about than me, but I will admit was a fun watch, if only because I'm a huge William Shatner fan. I'm a big Trekkie.
Oh my God.
Impulse was that period when Shatner was literally living out of his car post Star Trek and there were no residuals coming his way. This is before anyone was like, maybe we should turn this into a movie. Like he didn't know what to do next.
Yeah.
Right. And like he would like, what, you know, he was enough.
That's
of
a great Shatner impression.
He
by
was
the way.
Enough of a name that he was like, hey, what do you got?
So much arm movements. Like and then what do you do?
Started the show here.
Is that what you were right. doing? Well, you were
what
doing
you
your Shatner?
Think.
No, no, no. I'm not giving you this. That was a shit
I mean, it was
Shatner.
Not really Shatner. I was playing on the idea and then I just took it somewhere else.
Jesus.
So.
Anyway, is the best movie of all time.
It is
Okay, let's talk about this.
1974
all day.
Thriller. They call him a serial killer, but that's feels wrong because he's not really a serial killer.
No,
he's a guy who's just kind of a dumbass misogynist who ends up killing people.
I think the title is actually way more apropos to what he is. It's just he's just impulsive and he ultimately kills a few people. He's only killed like three people. It's not like he's like meaning to do it every single time. He's like, well, I got another choice, but
I suspect one of the problems with this film with people want to connect with it is it sells it as a supernatural film with all the original advertising, like the poster and everything, like sells supernatural aspects. There's no supernatural aspects at all to Impulse. The only thing supernatural about this film is this new release, which is like a two-disc release with an insane amount of bonus features.
This is maybe, I'm going to go on a limb here, maybe the best physical released copy of anything ever, because this is chock full of so much shit. I cannot wait to talk about that part, but we could talk about the movie for a little bit.
All right. Now because you love it so much, you have to describe the plot.
Okay. So,
partially because I it's a haze for me.
So I was drinking, a sip of scotch with Eric Samaniego from Trash in the Can, only on oneofus.net. And we were watching this together, and it starts in a flashback where Matt Stone, who is a younger Matt Stone, William Shatner's character, he basically walks in on his mom about to fuck this guy. And this is like in the this takes place in the 70s, so this must be in the 50s.
Yeah.
And the young kid, young Matt Stone, ultimately kills the boyfriend because he's so freaked out because the boyfriend becomes belligerent, awful, blah blah blah.
The boyfriend is physically assaulting the mom. Yeah,
and so and kills it. So now present day Matt Stone, you know what he feels like? I think they must have based this a little bit on what's the good looking serial killer, Ted Bundy, because he's kind of a man about town, sort of, because everyone's just kind of like, oh man, you're a really good looking guy.
It's William Shatner.
Sure. And,
At the time he was considered to be quite the.
Yeah. I mean, he looks like a potato, but like, yeah.
Really?
Look at him. He looks like me on this cover.
Yeah. Only 70 pounds lighter, but still.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
I mean, I'm just as critical towards myself. Okay.
I'm not critical towards myself. You're critical towards me.
People often say you're like Brad Pitt. If he had
if his corpse was rotting for 20 years. Okay. So
they do say that.
So he, basically, he is trying to find his
rotting corpse. Really?
I'm just saying, like, for the past 30 years. Past 30 years.
I'll take 10.
All right. So, a little bit of bloat.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bloat. So, so Matt Stone, now in present day, he is basically a philanderer guy. Like, he has this one lady on, like, on the hook, with, like, trying to like take money from her a little bit, but she's like finally like wise up to him and says like, fuck you, no way. And then he also takes matters in his own hands, but he doesn't even like realize it in the moment. Now, what's really fun about this movie is that William Shatner is schmacting the fuck out of this movie.
Oh man.
Man.
I mean, that's the appeal.
That's the appeal, right?
A trashy, poorly shot film, poorly written film. But he is just doing his best to be the star. Like, yes. He did not go into this like, I'm just taking the paycheck. He is.
Oh, he's committing.
He's committing.
Also, I don't know what he's committing to. Made in a insane asylum.
You know the movie Goldfinger?
Yes.
So the actor from that who played Odd Job.
Yeah.
Plays a role here, which his whole character arc makes no sense in this movie whatsoever.
And it's so strange. Okay, so. Anyway, you find he basically gets himself involved because he's so handsome with the local community that he finds himself in, where Jennifer Bishop is this local single mom because her husband passed away at some point, starts to become his girlfriend, and her very talky, catty friend, played by Ruth Roman, who fans of Trash the Kid would know that she is the mama from The Baby, and she is the most amazing actress in existence.
I love the baby.
I love the baby so much. And Ruth Roman is so fucking still badass in this movie. She's so fun and, you know, just being gossipy all the time. It's like, oh, who's that? Like, oh God, she's so fucking good. Like, so Eric and I were watching this together. We flipped the fuck out as soon as Ruth Roman was like, oh shit. And like, we were almost scared for William Shatner. It's like, oh man, she's got a badass bitch. You better watch out. So anyway, He basically ingrains himself very, like, almost how to succeed in business without really trying in a way, like falling upwards, where he talks about, like, wanting to invest things, and it spirals out of control, where he's getting involved with this, this woman, and her daughter is like, fuck him, he's creepy, something's up with him, I don't care for him because he's, like, you know, also taking the place of my father who recently passed away. Mm-hmm. And then she starts to slowly find out that, you know, he's a murderer, and he's really unhinged, and it just goes off the rails towards the end. It really does. And it is fucking great. So,
as I said, there's like the movie and then a whole extra disc of extra features and then extra features even on the primary disc. Two of the extra features are two other entire movies by this bullshit director.
Yes. Yeah. So, okay, Eric and I were fascinated by all of this because we started to put on, like, okay, what are the extra features? One, yeah, like you said, there's two extra movies on here. They don't even put it on the disc itself, like, name them what they are. But one of them is called The Godmother, starring Mickey Rooney and where it's a movie that we've been trying to look for on physical or digital.
You were so excited when I passed this off to you. You were like, oh, my God.
It's like,
the Holy Grail.
Yeah. It's like, I have to keep this disc, cause we are going to do one of those movies on Trash the Can. But then we sort of dive deeper into other bonus features. There is like goddamn 20 to 30 minute industrial film where William Shatner and his wife, who plays a character, she's like the motel clerk, in the movie. She also has to get.
Yeah. No, and she's hot.
She's hot. She has like, to bang him in the movie.
First wife, I think.
Third, I think.
Third? Yeah. Really?
He's had like five. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
She's
really hot. She's a small role.
He's a hot potato.
Yeah. I met him. He was.
He's shaped like a potato.
I put him in the microwave. It's like a minute and a half and he was hot.
Oh, he's a baked potato. But, just them two. And they're just thinking about like, Bacardi, isn't that, such a great drink? And like, yes, it is. We should learn about it. You should go to Jamaica or wherever the hell it is. It's a whole industrial film about them going to the Bacardi distillery. And
oh, wow.
It's hysterical. It's just like the owner of Bacardi is like, so this is how we do this. This is how the science goes into this.
They found all this weird extra shit with.
And Lord Bacall talking about, how you should invest in Hollywood and how much money it's making right now. I'm Lord Bacall.
This is this kind of release that just was like, anything we can get that relates in any way to this film.
But it's only because the director did all those things. Yeah. He directed all that crap. It is one of the best physical releases of like just content I've seen in years.
Both the extra, like not even on the package films that are here have their own extra features as well.
Right.
Bonus features. And my favorite thing, like the guy who played Odd Job in Goldfinger.
Oh, Harold Sicarda?
Yeah. Who plays a small role here. There's a scene where William Shatner like is killing him by hanging him. And apparently the rig broke. And the thing is, he's supposed to be like, I'm dying. And everybody was like, okay, well, he's overacting, but sure. And Shatner was the one who realized something was wrong and saved his fucking life. Like, wow. Apparently, like I read a whole thing about it where they're like, yeah, if he hadn't stepped into that moment, he definitely would have died.
Yeah.
And that footage exists and is here on the fucking thing where he grabs him and the freak says like, oh shit. And Shatner picks him up who had just broken his fucking finger doing the scene. Like he had, cause it was the thing where he had dropped down or a level.
There's a lot of physical shit that he does.
And they kept this is the cut. Like, all that's in the film. He had broken his finger and he just went, and kept going and like did it. And with a broken finger, single-handedly lifted this gigantic Asian man up in the air.
Yeah.
You know, like, wow. I can't believe, I want to see a fucking like friendship story between the two of them after that, you know? Well,
I love all of this. Like, there's so much involved with this dumb movie and on this disc that it is delightful. You should own it. In fact, you should buy three copies.
Why would you buy three copies?
I don't know, just for prosperity.
All right, so I'm going to just rule this out as pick of the week right now. So
wait, rule it out?
Why can't I do that?
Wait, we can't pick it?
Oh, is that your pick of the week?
Oh, maybe.
Was that what you were intending on your pick of the week?
Oh, maybe.
All right, fine. Impulse is the pick of the week.
Yay! Jesus. This is the best digital noise ever.
I'm very reluctant about
What was your stupid-ass pick of the week?
Terrible fucking
movie. Witness of prosecution or whatever the fuck's called?
No, actually, McCabe and Miss Miller would have been my pick of
the week. Really?
Yeah. Because great selection of extra features, great 4K upgrade. Like, it's a great movie.
That's like a very hard second for me.
Okay, fine. We'll do Impulse to please you.
Wait, can we do Impulse and McCabe?
No, because that would require my Photoshop skills, which barely exist.
Ooh. Yeah. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Yeah.
Choice.
You're going to have to take the L on this. I'm going to take the W.
You're going to take the Impulse?
No, I'm going to take the Impulse because I love this too much. This is one of the few movies I've watched in a long time and on a physical release like this where I'm like, yeah, I'm going to jack off to that tonight.
Oh, boy. Like, I handed this movie to this guy thinking he was going to be like, oh, what the fuck are you making me watch? And his eyes lit up and he was like, his voice got all husky.
I was like,
thank you.
Well, I was like, I've got a golden ticket.
Do you want me to suck your dick? And the answer was yes, but, you know.
Well, I thought he said hand job, but he was talking about odd job the entire time.
Yeah,
so.
That's what I was talking about.
Yeah. Okay, never mind.
That's our pick of the week. This has been Digital Noise. I regret every second of it.
Fuck you, fuckers.